Before the present writer lie half a dozen books, and there are good indices to three of them. He can pick up any one of these six books, refer quickly to a statement, verify a quotation, and go on writing. Contrast with that the tedious unfolding of a rolled manuscript. Close at hand are two encyclopedias, a dictionary, an atlas of the world, a biographical dictionary, and other books of reference. They have no marginal indices, it's true, but that perhaps is asking for too much at present. There were no such resources in the world in 300 BC. Alexandria had still to produce the first grammar and the first dictionary. This present book is being written in manuscript. It's then taken by a typist and typewritten very accurately. It can then, with the utmost convenience, be read over, corrected amply, rearranged freely, retyped and recorrected. The Alexandrian author had to dictate or recopy every word he wrote. Before he could turn back to what he had written previously, he had to dry his last words by waving them in the air or pouring sand over them. He hadn't even blotting paper. Whatever an author wrote had to be recopied again and again before it could reach any considerable circle of readers, and every copyist introduced some new error. Whenever a need for maps or diagrams arose, there were fresh difficulties. Such a science as anatomy, for example, depending as it does upon accurate drawing, must have been enormously hampered by the natural limitations of the copyist. The transmission of geographical fact, again, must have been almost incredibly tedious. No doubt a day will come when a private library and writing desk of the year AD 1919 will seem quaintly clumsy and difficult, but measured by the standards of Alexandria, they are astonishingly quick, efficient, and economical of nervous and mental energy. No attempt seems to have been made at Alexandria to print anything at all. That strikes one at first as a very remarkable fact. The world was crying out for books, and not simply for books. There was an urgent public need for notices, proclamations, and the like. Yet there's nothing in the history of the Western civilizations that one can call printing until the 15th century AD. It's not as though printing was a recondite art or dependent upon any precedent and preliminary discoveries. Printing is the most obvious of dodges. In principle, it's always been known. As we've already stated, there's ground for supposing that the Paleolithic men of the Magdalenian period may have printed designs on their leather garments. The seals of ancient Sumeria, again, were printing devices. Coins are print. Illiterate persons in all ages have used wooden or metal stamps for their signatures. William I, the Norman conqueror of England, for example, used such a stamp with ink to sign documents. In China, the classics were being printed by the 2nd century AD. Yet either because of a complex of small difficulties about ink or papyrus or the form of books, or because of some protective resistance on the part of the owners of the slave copyists, or because the script was too swift and easy to set men thinking how to write it still more easily, as the Chinese character or the Gothic letters did, or because of a gap in the social system between men of thought and knowledge and men of technical skill, printing wasn't used, not even used, for the exact reproduction of illustrations. The chief reason for this failure to develop printing systematically lies, no doubt, in the fact that there was no abundant supply of printable material of a uniform texture and convenient form. The supply of papyrus was strictly limited. Strip had to be fastened to strip, and there was no standard size of sheet. Paper had yet to come from China to release the mind of Europe. Had there been presses, they would have had to stand idle while the papyrus rolls were slowly made. But this explanation doesn't account for the failure to use block printing in the case of illustrations and diagrams. These limitations enable us to understand why it was that Alexandria could at once achieve the most extraordinary intellectual triumphs. For such a feat as that of Eratosthenes, for instance, having regard to his poverty of apparatus, it's sufficient to put him on a level with Newton or Pasteur, and yet have little or no effect upon the course of politics or the lives and thoughts of people round about her. Her museum and library were a centre of light, but it was light in a dark lantern hidden from the general world. There were no means of carrying its results even to sympathetic men abroad, except by tedious letter-writing. There was no possibility of communicating what was known there to the general body of men. Students had to come at great cost to themselves to this crowded centre, because there was no other way of gathering even scraps of knowledge. At Athens and Alexandria there were bookstalls, where manuscript notebooks of variable quality could be bought at reasonable prices, but any extension of education to larger classes and other centres would have produced at once a restrictive shortage of papyrus. Education didn't reach into the masses at all. To become more than superficially educated, one had to abandon the ordinary life of the times and come for long years to live a hovering existence in the neighbourhood of ill-equipped and overworked sages. Learning wasn't indeed so complete a withdrawal from ordinary life as initiation into a priesthood, but it was still something in that nature. And very speedily, that feeling of freedom, that openness and directness of statement which is the vital air of the true intellectual life, faded out of Alexandria. From the first, the patronage even of Ptolemy the First set a limit to political discussion. Presently the dissensions of the schools let in the superstitions and prejudices of the city mob to scholastic affairs. Wisdom passed away from Alexandria and left pedantry behind. For the use of books was substituted the worship of books. Very speedily the learned became a specialized queer class with unpleasant characteristics of its own. The museum hadn't existed for half a dozen generations before Alexandria was familiar with a new type of human being, shy, eccentric, unpractical, incapable of essentials, strangely fierce upon trivialities of literary detail, as bitterly jealous of the colleague within as of the unlearned without, the bent, scholarly man. He was as intolerant as a priest, though he had no altar, as obscurantist as a magician, though he had no cave. For him, no method of copying was sufficiently tedious and no rare book sufficiently inaccessible. He was a sort of by-product of the intellectual process of mankind. For many precious generations, the new-lit fires of the human intelligence were to be seriously banked down by this by-product. Right thinking is necessarily an open process, and the only science and history of full value to men consist of what is generally and clearly known. This is surely a platitude, but we've still to discover how to preserve our centres of philosophy and research from the caking and darkening accumulations of narrow and dingy-spirited specialists. We have still to ensure that a man of learning shall be none the less a man of affairs, and that all that can be thought and known is kept plainly, honestly, and easily available to the ordinary men and women who are the substance of mankind. Second, at first, the mental activities of Alexandria centred upon the museum and were mainly scientific. Philosophy, which in a more vigorous age had been a doctrine of power over self and the material world, without abandoning these pretensions, became in reality a doctrine of secret consolation. The stimulant changed into an opiate. The philosopher let the world, as the vulgar say, rip, the world of which he was a part, and consoled himself by saying, in very beautiful and elaborate forms, that the world was illusion, and that there was in him something quintessential and sublime, outside and above the world.